Welcome to the Kings and Queens podcast with your host, Johnny Langton. The US Declaration of Independence described him as marked by every act which may define a tyrant. At home, he was described as one of the most conscientious sovereigns who ever sat upon the English throne. Yet he vehemently opposed Catholic emancipation and the abolition of slavery. His characterizations are almost as broad as the events that unfolded during his long reign. It saw an independent United States and a revolutionary France. It saw the Age of Enlightenment, the Age of Industry, Science and Technology, and the Age of Imperialism that would see Europe reach the peak of its global power. This is George III. George was born in Norfolk House, London, on the 4th of June, 1738. He was the son of Frederick, the Prince of Wales, and Princess Augusta of Saxe-Gotha. His grandfather was George II, King of Great Britain and Ireland, and the Elector of Hanover. He was born 2 months premature, and was not expected to survive, so he was baptised on the day of his birth. However, he grew healthy. He was reserved and shy. Due to his father's hostility towards the king, the younger George grew up, in part, separate from his grandfather. He was educated by private tutors alongside his brother Edward. Along with traditional subjects, he was the first royal to study science systematically, including chemistry, physics, maths, and astronomy, the latter becoming one of his lifelong passions. He soon had his own astronomical observatory. He would make drawings and calculations of the transit of planets across the sun. Many of his instruments and drawings are displayed to this day in science museums across the country. He was described as a pleasant character, silent, modest, and easily abashed. His schoolwork was considered poor and young for his years, but George would soon become known as one of Britain's exceptionally cultured monarchs. In 1751, George's father Frederick died. He was struck by a blow from a cricket ball, which some sources have claimed may have caused an abscess to develop on the lung, later bursting. It could also have been a pulmonary embolism. He was 44. The 12-year-old George was now heir. The old king soon became more interested in his grandson, determined to mould him. Young George's mother Augusta was determined to not let that happen. She considered the king weak. Along with her friend, Lord Bute, who became a new father figure for the young teen, they raised him as a patriot king, one who would rule above party politics. In practice, one who would end Whig domination and secure more power for the monarch to rule with benevolence, in the best interest of the nation. It was also very much in the best interest of Bute, who was a prominent, ambitious Tory politician, knew just how valuable his position was as an avuncular figure to a young, malleable prince. On the 25th of October 1760, George II died at the age of 76. It was relatively unexpected. The king had been old, but not ailing. George succeeded his grandfather at the age of 22. He was still single, the first monarch since Charles II to ascend the throne as a bachelor. Negotiations began to find an eligible German princess. The young George had already fallen in love. Bute strongly advised George not to marry Sarah Lennox, as she was low-born. A far cry from the intelligent, enlightened Queen Caroline, wife of George II. George wanted a child-bearing wife. He even dismissed one princess due to her interest in philosophy. He instead settled for Charlotte of Mecklenburg, an obscure German duchy. Their wedding day would be the first time the pair would meet. Despite the arranged marriage, George never took a mistress, and the pair enjoyed a long and happy marriage, nicknaming each other Mr. and Mrs. King. They had 15 children, 9 sons and 6 daughters. She was escorted over the English Channel by British warships commanded by none other than Horatio Nelson, who would be a national hero during George's reign. On the 22nd of September 1761, the pair were crowned King and Queen in one of the nation's most memorable coronations, for all the wrong reasons. It was characterised by astounding blunders. Lord Effingham was put in charge, and it was poorly organised and rehearsed. The ceremony was delayed for 3 hours because Effingham forgot the sword of state. Like the coronation of his predecessor, scaffolds were erected in Westminster Abbey to allow for more spectators, yet they were out of earshot. When the Archbishop of Canterbury began his sermon, he couldn't be heard, so the spectators in the stands began chatting and eating instead. The service itself was plagued with long pauses, because no one knew what was next in the programme. At the banquet, not enough chairs were laid, meaning leading aristocrats were left seething when they had no place at the table. Finally, and perhaps most memorably, was the role of Lord Talbot. He was due to greet the King and Queen on horseback. Due to the custom of never turning your back on royalty, he had trained his horse to trot backwards, meaning he could trot away after the greeting without having to turn. However, the horse, so accustomed to his training, started walking backwards on his way in, meaning the King and Queen had full view only of the horse's rear. The calamity of the coronation could certainly, by historical standards, be a bad omen. They could perhaps be given credence when considering George's first few years were plagued with instability, suspicion, and division. Upon his succession, George was determined to betray himself as first and foremost British. He proclaimed, "I was born and educated in this country. I glory in the name of Britain." He saw it as crucial to distance himself from his Hanoverian forebears, who were perceived as caring more for Hanover than Britain. George certainly lacked the emotional attachment. He was true to his word. Despite speaking German, having German blood, and a German wife, not once during his reign did he visit Hanover, of which he was now the elector. He was now set on ruling with the old Stuart royal prerogative by manipulating patronage. In his accession speech, he referred to the Seven Years' War, in which Britain was currently engaged, as the Bloody War. Though he quickly toned down his rhetoric, it was clear the king was not prepared to be as passive as his grandfather in his later years. He was determined to be the patriot king, one who was above all faction, was virtuous, impartial, yet powerful enough to override parties. Bute and George had felt betrayed when William Pitt had formed a ministry with the current Prime Minister Thomas Pelham. Bute told Pitt that the King would have no meetings with him in which Bute was not present. It would be difficult to remove Pelham and Pitt from their positions. The latter was still riding a wave of patriotism following military success. Yet Bute schemed and manipulated Pelham and Pitt, and following the resignation of both, became the first Tory and the first Scot to become Prime Minister, less than a year after George's coronation, in May 1762. This led to accusations that George was linked to the Tories and held illiberal views on government. His apparent favouritism towards the Tories echoed Stuart autocracy, and he was surrounded by villainous ministers determined to undermine democracy. It was a very familiar story. Bute was very unpopular with colleagues and the public, and it was a poor reflection on the king. The nation was reeling from Pitt's resignation. The cry of the people in the taverns and alehouses was "No Pitt, no King." In his publication North Britain, MP John Wilkes suggested the king lied from the throne, as he was misled by ministers. He was accused of libel, expelled, and imprisoned. It prompted mass protests. The public rallied behind the radical MP, who quickly became a symbol of free speech. He was famous for his wicked turn of phrase. When Lord Sandwich told him, "You will either die on the gallows or at the pox," Wilkes quipped, "That, sir, depends on whether I embrace your principles or your mistress." The King and Bute ultimately lost their moral tussle with Wilkes. Bute also lost his personal fight. Amidst rabid anti-Scottish sentiment from the Whigs and persistent accusations in the media that he was sleeping with the King's mother, he decided he'd had enough and resigned after less than a year. His stock fell. In a role persistent for centuries, he was perhaps the very last of the royal favourites. Though Bute was gone, George would not experience stability. Over the next 7 years, George appointed 4 different prime ministers, each with fragile ministries and coalitions. The King appointed George Grenville, following the Marquess of Rockingham, before finally landing on William Pitt. Though he'd had a remarkable career, Pitt had never held the coveted post. George asked him to draw a ministry for more sections of the Houses of Parliament. But the year was 1766. Pitt was old, gout-ridden, and would attend Commons debates covered in flannels and supported by sticks. He also made a huge faux pas. He insisted on ruling from the Lords and was given the Earldom of Chatham. The temerity of the great commoner to give in to the allure of the establishment horrified many. The poet Thomas Gray was scathing. "It is the weakest thing ever done by so great a man." He was in no position to form a coherent ministry, especially from the Lords. Pitt grew depressed and became a recluse, hiding in his room for days. He resigned 2 years later. Finally, in February 1770, George landed on Lord North, a man he liked and trusted, and someone who could provide stability. He would rule for 12 years, the longest tenure since Walpole. He'd become known, however, as arguably the very worst Prime Minister in British history. The man who lost America. The treaty that brought the Seven Years' War to its conclusion was signed in 1763. Britain gained sovereignty over Canada, many Caribbean islands, and a large swathe of land in America, from the Mississippi River to the Appalachian Mountains. The Seven Years' War had doubled national debt from 70 to 140 million pounds. Half of tax revenue was spent on interest alone. The annual cost of the upkeep of the 13 American colonies increased from 75 to £350,000. This was crucial to what would follow. In times of economic strife, Britons would point the finger to their colonial brethren. Why don't they contribute? Pitt had framed the purpose of the war around helping the long-injured, long-neglected and forgotten people of America. The colonies were now collectively 5 times the size of England, and the cities of New York, Philadelphia and Boston were now rich. Meanwhile, even with the French gone, Britain would still foot the bill for the defence of America against native uprisings. Yet they didn't pay tax. The Americans argued that the British soldiers were an unwelcome imposition. The French were indeed gone, so they didn't need to be there. In the spring of 1765, the Stamp Act was introduced to Parliament. It required colonialists to pay a tax on forms, documents, newspaper ads, and playing cards, represented by a stamp. It was expected to raise £60,000 per year. It would be imposed without the approval of colonial legislatures, and payable in British sterling, not colonial currency, harder to obtain. Those who refused to comply could be prosecuted. The Act passed through an almost empty chamber, and little was made of it in Britain, yet it set America alight. Enraged colonists nullified the Act by outright refusing to use the stamps. The stamps were burned, riots spread, and stamp distributors were intimidated. pressure from American and British merchants persuaded the British government to repeal the act. The king responded by claiming that the matter requires more deliberation, candour and temper than I fear it will be met with. The Stamp Act was nothing new. It had been implemented across the empire, and the Americans had been treated far fairer than the Irish, for example. Yet the dispute that began over trade and taxes grew into a moral question of civil rights and liberty. Americans were declared that the English crown had no right to tax Americans who lacked representation in Parliament. Though the Stamp Act was repealed the following year, it would not mark the end of the moral dispute. In the summer of 1767, four acts were passed through the British Parliament to assert what it considered its historic right to exert authority over its colonies and its recalcitrant assemblies, and to raise money for its debt. It imposed new import duties on such products as glass, paper, and tea. Everywhere the acts were resisted. Colonists refused to pay. Violence spread once more, and two British regiments had to be dispatched to restore order in Boston. Organisations such as the Sons of Liberty organised non-importation agreements with all the colonies except New Hampshire, curtailing British trade, adding pressure on the British government. In response, the cabinet abolished all duties except one, tea. In tea, the Americans would actually pay significantly less than the Brits, just 3 pence per pound, as opposed to the British, who paid 12 pence. Yet now all trust was gone. Suspicion and tax had cultivated a new wave of anti-British American revolutionary thought. For many in the colonies, this was a war to protect the freedom and liberty of Americans. George himself was outraged that any of his subjects would encourage rebellious disposition. Lord North said he repealed the acts as a very last resort. Violence continued, however, especially in Boston and the colony of Massachusetts. In March 1770, five colonialists were killed in an incident later labelled the Boston Massacre. The Boston Gazette characterised the massacre as part of an ongoing scheme to quell a spirit of liberty. Then, on the 16th of December 1773, 40 patriots disguised as Mohawk Indians boarded three tea ships in Boston Harbour and emptied £10,000 worth of tea overboard. It became known as the Boston Tea Party. Mutual suspicion and hostilities increased dramatically. The distance between Britain and America meant mutual understanding was even more difficult to achieve. The 4 to 6 week transatlantic delay exacerbated problems of communication, and news reports were exaggerated by media outlets in America and Britain. After the Tea Party, British opinions of the colonists soured. Pitt agreed with his rival Lord North that this was indeed criminal and retribution was required. Now, with parliamentary support, North introduced the Coercive Acts, also known as the Intolerable Acts, in 1774, as a direct response to acts of colonial defiance. Most of the actions fell on Boston, the centre of colonial hostility. The Boston Port Bill closed it until the government were reimbursed for the tea that had been poured into Boston Harbour. The Massachusetts Government Act abrogated its charter, effectively demoting it as a crown colony. It replaced its elective council with an appointed one and enhanced the powers of a military governor. The Justice Act protected British officials from the American courts, and the Quartering Act gave British troops the right to requisition unoccupied buildings. All the acts were attempts to reimpose strict British control over the colonies. Instead, it fueled the fire of revolution. It stimulated the 1774 Congress in Philadelphia, where they wrote the Declaration of Rights. British imports were boycotted, and repeals were demanded. In April 1775, a skirmish on Lexington Green left 8 Americans dead. At Concord, the British were met with militia. A total of 273 British and 93 Americans were killed. War had begun. For 5 years, a cat-and-mouse war waged between rebels and loyalists. George kept a close eye on all details of activities. He had a voracious interest, even down to the number of blankets required for soldiers to the number of cannons on each ship, recording it in his own hand. He viewed the war as a rebellion. He had no second thought for the troubles of the colonists, demanding a speedy end to those disorders by the most decisive exertions. While many Brits saw the rebels as anarchists, cowardly attacking peacekeepers, the war did split opinions. MP Charles Fox called it an unjust war and urged North to bring it to an end. Pitt called the conquest of America an impossibility. They were critical of the King's role of trying to interfere and manipulate those in Parliament. They thought the King was overreaching, and parliamentary reform was required to preserve liberty. Then, on the 4th of July 1776, with war waging, the Declaration of Independence was published, largely written by Thomas Jefferson. One of its most famous passages read, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, but among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." The United States of America was born. George was the Declaration's chief target. He was described as unfit to be the ruler of free people. He was marked by every act with which defines a tyrant. No less than 27 grievances were listed. Thomas Paine called George the royal brute of Great Britain. Benjamin Franklin called the British administration wicked and accused them of trying to enslave America. The war had largely united the 13 colonies that previously lacked a true collective identity. The Declaration now gave them this identity, while still retaining their distinctive cultures.
Come listen and I'll tell you how first I went to sea to fight against the British and win our liberty. We shipped with Captain Whipple, who never knew a fear, the captain of the Providence, the Yankee privateer. We sailed and we sailed and kept good cheer, for not a British frigate could overcome the privateer. Southern and suddenly did meet three British frigates convoyed to a West Indian fleet. Old Whipple put our lights out and crawled upon their rear, and not a soul suspected the Yankee privateer. We sailed and kept good cheer, for not a British frigate could overcome the privateer.
Britain achieved early success in the war. General Howe captured New York, Rhode Island, and New Jersey. General George Washington avoided conflict early. He was aware that the Brits were better trained and better equipped. An American preparation had been poor. But Washington had home advantage. The British had to rely upon transatlantic crossings to supply and relieve troops. In December 1776, Washington crossed the Delaware and retook New Jersey, along with 900 prisoners. It roused the new nation and kept the struggle for independence alive. Then, in October the following year, the British general Burgoyne surrendered at Saratoga. Despite surprising success, the Americans were hanging on. In February 1778, the tide turned as France entered the war. It was purely a marriage of convenience. France had the most traditional absolute monarchy in Europe and was the antithesis of the ideas of American liberty. France entered for retribution against the British. They sent fleets to stretch the British Navy. In September 1781, General Cornwallis found himself besieged at Yorktown by Washington's army on land and an effective French blockade at sea. They waited in vain for rescue or reinforcements, as they ran out of supplies. On the 19th of October, 7,000 British troops surrendered. When news reached Britain, it was viewed as a final surrender, and almost all military activities ended. George was devastated. Upon opinions of suing for peace, he drafted a letter of abdication. He toiled, but eventually changed his mind. A treaty signed 2 years later stripped Britain of her 13 colonies in America and recognized the independence of the United States. The war had cost 43,000 lives and almost doubled Britain's national debt. Britain had now lost 500,000 square miles of her empire and 2.5 million subjects. It was an almighty blow to Britain's reputation. The Holy Roman Emperor predicted Britain would swiftly become a second-class power. Catherine the Great, Empress of Russia, reacted, "Rather than lose America as Cousin George has done, I would have fired a pistol at my own head." It was also the end for Lord North. His ministry fell following a vote of no confidence. For the next few years, George desperately tried to appoint a prime minister who could once again unite the country after several failed ministries and further division. George's main opposition was that of Charles Fox. Fox was powerful, loud, boorish, a heavy gambler, and womaniser. The absolute opposite of a king. He had openly supported America during the war, and had even worn the colours of Washington's army. The hatred was mutual. Fox called the king a blockhead. Despite calling North a lump of deformity and disease, he formed a coalition with him to topple a common enemy. The king was outraged. He manoeuvres well and appoints William Pitt Prime Minister. Not the Pitt of old. He had died several years before, but his son, 24-year-old William Pitt the Younger. He became and remains Britain's youngest Prime Minister. Just 3 months after Pitt was appointed, Fox called a motion of no confidence in a House of Commons where Pitt garnered limited support. Though petitions of support from his base helped him survive, Pitt, in March 1784, went to the country. George spent over £2 million on Pitt's campaign. The Treasury paid for patronages and bribes to ensure Pitt returned enough MPs to gain a majority. It was a significant victory, with Pitt getting 70% of the seats. George's pro-trade, war-sceptic candidate was secure in office as Fox's base crumbled. Pitt was a great manager, financier, and a relentless workhorse. Under Pitt, Britain experienced a period of prosperity and stability. It resulted in popularity, not just for Pitt, but for George, who was now rejuvenated, slim, and fit in middle age. Meanwhile, Britain was entering a new age of exploration. John Harrison's chronometers allowed for longitude to be measured at sea. This was vital for effective navigation, and it accelerated colonialism. Long-distance travel could now be much more accurate. In the 1640s, Dutchman Abel Tasman had become the first European to discover Australia and New Zealand. James Cook then became the first European to contact the eastern coast of Australia and to circumnavigate New Zealand. He charted Tonga and Easter Island, discovering New Caledonia in the Pacific and the South Sandwich Islands and South Georgia Island in the Atlantic. He met his end in Hawaii in 1779 when he was attacked and killed. The eastern coast of Australia was renamed New South Wales, and a penal colony was established at Botany Bay in 1788. Yet as early as 1750, a period of profound change was underway. What began as mechanisation of a textile industry would eventually transform every aspect of life, from transport to agriculture. It created the modern world. It was the Industrial Revolution. At the heart of the revolution was invention. Such inventions as the spinning jenny and the water frame helped start the factory system of cotton manufacturing. However, it was the development of the steam engine which underpinned the revolution. Production was moved into factories, and the mechanisation of cotton spinning increased the output of the worker by 500%. The invention of coke smelting revolutionised iron production. Railway and canal networks revolutionised travel. Agricultural productivity doubled. Society was totally transformed. The pace of population growth reached levels not matched in all of history. Cities sprawled out in every direction, and factories scarred the skylines. The estimated population of England and Wales at the start of George III's reign was around 6 million. By 1820, it was around 17 million. Britain became the workshop of the world, and would grow immensely rich. Britain also benefited from a triangular slave trade. Most of these textiles and manufactured goods were sent to Africa in exchange for slaves. The slaves were then sent to America and into servitude. In exchange, sugar, tobacco, and cotton was brought back to Britain, further fueling manufacturing for enormous profits. Such profits would fund infrastructure, inventions, and technology. Slave traders paved the streets of Britain's cities and were later venerated in the forms of statues in parks and squares, benefiting directly from a system that enslaved millions. In 1807, after an estimated 12,000 slaving voyages over a 100-year period, where over 3 million enslaved Africans were purchased, George signed into law the Act for the Abolition of the Slave Trade, banning trading in enslaved people in the British Empire. This ended the buying and selling of enslaved people within the British Empire, but it did not protect those already enslaved. Many traders continued to trade illegally. It would take a further 30 years of determined and vigorous campaigning before it was totally abolished in 1833. Those traders who were venerated received a share of £20 million, around £17 billion in today's money, in compensation for their loss. George opposed slavery, calling it equally repugnant in the civil law as to the law of nature, although he would later reject the abolition movement. George's array of interests was remarkable. He had a deep interest in the arts. He aided the Royal Academy, donating perhaps up to half of his income to charity, and opened the King's Library. It is today considered one of the most important collections of Enlightenment books and pamphlets, numbering 65,000 books. He played the harpsichord, the flute, and the pianoforte. In 1764, he welcomed an 8-year-old Austrian wonder to the newly purchased Buckingham Palace to perform for King and Queen. It was Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. In the same year, Capability Brown became the king's gardener at Hampton Court. He painted watercolours, even teaching the skill to his wife. He was a patron of painter Benjamin West, who by 1801 had painted 65 portraits of George at the cost of £35,000. He was also a patron of William Herschel, who originally named his greatest discovery after the king himself, calling it Georgium Sidus, before it was given another name in order for it to be in conformity with the other planetary names, and was henceforth named Uranus. He had other unusual, less fashionable interests. He was nicknamed Farmer George due to his fascination with agriculture. He even wrote articles on the processes under the pseudonym Ralph Robinson. He would regularly visit farms and had his own sons cultivate a strip of land in their youth, much to their chagrin. By many, he was considered middle-aged as a young man, and stayed that way. Travel was not one of his interests. In fact, he never left the south of England. He would holiday in Weymouth, contributing greatly to its emergence as a holiday destination. He was also unusual as a king in his priorities. He took a keen interest in his own health. He would regularly exercise and watched his diet. He would avoid overeating and drinking, and was particularly watchful of his intake of sugar. While he was not considered to be bright, he was incredibly hard-working and was very conscious of fulfilling his duties. His first few years were difficult. He made mistake after mistake and was naive. He grew in confidence and became shrewd. He was also deeply religious and issued a royal proclamation for the encouragement of piety and virtue. He enamoured himself with the people. He was seen as generous and modest. He often spoke to commoners on his walks. He was the first king in generations to speak to his subjects with an English accent. This mattered. He was also entirely faithful to his wife, whom he loved. On one occasion, he was so impatient to see the queen after a visit, he opened the chaise himself and jumped out before any of the attendants could come to his assistance, and carried his wife in his arms into his chambers. George and Charlotte raised 13 children into adulthood. The king had built a moral home life and strictly controlled his children's upbringing. His daughters complained that they basically lived in a nunnery. Two were able to finally marry as they approached 40. Other daughters were never given that opportunity. Their children were loath to accept their parents' views on marriage and their choice of partners. Yet their relationships often contrasted the prudish image king and queen wished to promote. George's brother, the Duke of Cumberland, was revealed to be an adulterer and was banished from court. This prompted the Royal Marriages Act in 1772. No descendant of George II could marry without the consent of the sovereign. This received severe criticism. However, king and queen could feel vindicated when another of George's brothers secretly married the illegitimate daughter of an English noble 6 years earlier. The law was not repealed until 2011. In a very familiar Hanoverian family story, the king shared little in common, nor was love lost, with his son. The Prince of Wales, also named George, was a gambler, a womaniser, and an alcoholic. He was avaricious and ostentatious. He was the polar opposite of his father. Disputes sometimes turned violent. In November 1788, George attacked his son and tried to smash his head against the wall. George's mouth foamed, and his eyes were so bloodshot that they looked like currant jelly. Yet George loved his son. He was protective and nurturing, unlike previous Georgians, who genuinely despised their sons. So why did he attack the Prince of Wales? George had suffered from a violent breakdown. He became incapacitated and delirious. He talked constantly for up to 19 hours at a time. He sent orders to people who were long dead. He suffered from agonizing pain, excited overactivity, and paralysis. He was placed in a straitjacket and later strapped to an iron chair. Doctors blamed it on him not drinking enough wine and sexual frustration due to his faithfulness to his plain wife. Doctors tried putting poultices, Spanish fly and mustard all over his body to draw out evil humours in freezing cold rooms, to no avail. 20th century medical investigation suggested that Peking had an inherited defect in his metabolism known as porphyria, though this is not universally accepted. With no recovery in sight, his illness precipitated the Regency crisis. One parliamentarian's pessimism summed the mood up. His Majesty's disorder is sealed in the brain. Surely his case must be hopeless. The Prince of Wales stepped up. Most agreed that he must become the regent, yet like his ancestors before him, the Prince of Wales had further provoked the king by joining ranks with political adversaries. This time, Charles Fox. Fox saw the incapacitation of the king as an opportunity for power. This made the matter deeply political. Pitt knew that this would result in his own downfall. The prince would certainly make his drinking buddy, Fox, prime minister. Pitt tried everything to restrict the regent's powers, and the issues were angrily debated. But while Pitt and Fox battled over the powers that would be granted to the regent, the king made a remarkable recovery, despite his doctors. By April 1789, the king had resumed his royal duties. The public rejoiced. The king rode a new wave of popularity. When he visited Weymouth that year, he was followed by a band. They even followed him into the sea. He was seen speaking to locals as equals, and was described by one as a worthy gentleman, the likes of which we have never seen in this realm. His modest touch proved to be a vital defence against the spread of revolutionary, political, and societal change that engulfed Britain's historical adversary across the Channel. The American Revolution had unleashed populism in France that could no longer be contained. Unlike Britain, France was still ruled by an absolute monarch. In 1789, he was Louis XVI. Along with the Queen Consort Marie Antoinette, they were known for their insatiable extravagance at a time that debt was mounting and bad harvests plunged the French population further into poverty. On the 14th of July, 1789, the dam burst. Citizens of Paris stormed the Bastille, France's medieval armoury, fortress and prison, the symbol of royal authority. The homes of tax collectors, landlords and aristocrats were burned. The King of France, Louis XVI, left with no choice, agreed to recognise a new national assembly that promotes equality of opportunity, freedom of speech, representative government, popular sovereignty, the end to feudalism, and the drafting of a new constitution. Louis's attempt to escape to restore his autocratic rule failed and his image tarnished. The first ever written French constitution was signed in September 1791 and a constitutional monarchy was founded. The revolution was welcomed initially by many in Britain, including Pitt, who saw this as a welcome change that would see France following Britain on the enlightened path to parliamentary democracy. George saw it as a divine punishment of the House of Bourbon for its support of the 13 colonies. Yet it naturally drew support for republicanism in Britain. Fox called it one of the most glorious events in the history of mankind. There was growing opposition to crown patronage and rotten boroughs. Groups pressed for greater social and economic change. Enlightenment thinker Thomas Paine promoted the idea that reason should rule, not be inherited. A meritocracy over aristocracy. Edmund Burke was not pleased with developments in France. He saw quick change as dangerous. Society should be preserved and improved. Reform should be gradual. History and tradition were the foundation of civilization. Burke became widely regarded as the philosophical founder of conservatism. While Pitt was pleased to have the belligerent neighbour distracted, Burke predicted that France was on the road to dictatorship. He was right. The new National Assembly was divided. The moderates were happy with the new constitution. Radicals were not. French politics quickly became factionalised. The most prominent radical faction was called the Jacobin Club, led by such figures as Georges Danton and Maximilien Robespierre. In August 1792, the Jacobins attacked the royal residence and arrested Louis. Waves of violence followed as Parisian insurrectionists massacred hundreds of accused counter-revolutionaries. A new national convention then replaced the assembly. The French monarchy was abolished and a new French republic established. On the 21st of January 1793, Louis is found guilty of treason and guillotined. In October, Marie Antoinette suffers the same fate. Robespierre claimed to be against capital punishment, but made such exceptions. A king whose very name draws foreign war on the nation. Neither prison nor exile can make his an innocent existence. It is with regret I pronounce the fatal truth. Louis must perish rather than 100,000 virtuous citizens. Louis must perish because our country must live. Robespierre emerged as a regime's leader. The reign of terror began. The Jacobins established a new calendar and began eradicating Christianity. In a 10-month period that followed, the Committee of Public Safety became the ruling power of France. Amidst revolutionary fervour, suspected enemies of liberty were guillotined in their thousands. While the official figures of deaths during the Reign of Terror sits at 16,000, the real figure is estimated to be around 40,000. However, in 1794, Robespierre was undone. He was arrested. He attempted suicide by shooting himself in the face, but only shattered his jaw. With 90 others, he was summarily guillotined. Edmund Burke further prophesied that a general would rise to rule the whole republic. Again, he was right. Upon Louis's death, Britain took notice. The radicals who were initially excited by events in France soon turned. The House of Commons assembled in mourning dress. Pitt described the execution on every principle by which men of justice and honour are actuated It is the foulest and most atrocious deed which the history of the world has yet had occasion to attest. Audiences demanded the curtain be drawn in theatres, and George's coach was surrounded by crowds demanding a declaration of war against France. He didn't need to. On the 1st of February 1793, France did it for him. 18 years of war followed. France was already at war with Austria, Russia, Prussia, Portugal, Sardinia, Spain, and the Netherlands. They formed a coalition with Britain. A nation of arms was created in France for total war. 1 million men were recruited with the will to win. Over the next 4 years, the coalition was routed. One by one, each nation signed peace treaties with France, leaving Britain alone. However, the Royal Navy balanced defeats on land with victories at sea. Back home, a paranoid Pitt passed a bill suspending habeas corpus, despite opposition from Charles Fox. Those advocating parliamentary reform were arrested and charged with sedition. Throughout the 1790s, there was a real fear that revolutionary ideas would spread across the Channel. Among those targeted was Thomas Paine. He escaped just in time. To pay for the wars, Pitt took out loans and raised tax. The combination of higher taxation and bad harvests drew angry protests. Despite the king attempting to show solidarity by eating just a slice of bread and some rice per day, he faced hecklers in the streets. He was a target of missiles. In response, Pitt redefined treason to prevent bodily harm to the king. Several attempts were made on the king's life. In 1800, a man fired 2 shots while he was in his royal box at Drury Lane Theatre. George, unperturbed, ordered the performance to be resumed shortly afterwards, even falling asleep during the interval. While the revolution would not be inspired in Great Britain, it would be inspired in Ireland. For centuries, a Protestant minority had dominated a Catholic majority. The Society of United Irishmen demanded reform, Catholic emancipation, and Irish independence. By 1797, they had 10,000 members. 15,000 French troops set sail for Ireland. Britain, stretched, had only a paltry force on the island. Storms meant the French invasion force never arrived. Britain had its luckiest escape since the Armada. Had the French been able to reach Ireland, it could have changed the course of history. Ireland could have secured its independence. Britain woke up. They arrested Irish rebel leaders and defeated rebellions in Wexford, Ulster, and Connacht. The repercussions were very significant. The rebellion convinced many in Britain that a British-Irish union was urgent and necessary. Large-scale corruption allowed the union to be passed through the Irish Parliament. Like the Scots in 1707, the Irish Parliament had voted to dissolve itself. On the 1st of January 1801, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland was formed. Pitt had sought to gain concessions for 75% of Irish Catholics who were still denied the vote. George opposed such a concession, as it violated his coronation oath to protect the Church of England. George's stubborn commitment to duty cost him Pitt. He resigned after 18 years as Prime Minister. By 1799, the British had formed a new coalition against the French, with Turkey, Russia and Austria. The year before, in May 1798, the British received word that the French were due to send a French naval expedition commanded by young Napoleon Bonaparte to capture Egypt. If the French dominated the Middle East, they would have control of the overland route to India. This was a clear threat to Britain. In response, Rear Admiral Horatio Nelson was sent to intercept a French fleet. While Napoleon took Alexandria, Nelson searched the seas. At last, on the 1st of August, he sighted 13 ships under Admiral François-Paul Voyez de Guier at anchor at Aboukir Bay. In a brutal battle, the French flagship exploded. The French were defeated, losing around 9,000 men. It isolated Napoleon's army in Egypt and secured British control of the Mediterranean. The following year, Napoleon joined a plot to overthrow the Directory. In November 1799, Napoleon is made the First Consul, or leader of France. It marked the end of the French Revolution and the beginning of the Napoleonic era. Napoleon declared, "I am the revolution." 5 years later, on the 2nd of December 1804, Napoleon was made Emperor of France, placing the crown on his own head. The war that began as an attempt for the French to maintain the strength of its revolution was now Napoleon's attempt to seize control of the balance of power in Europe. When the French defeated the Austrians in 1800, they became the dominant power on the continent. The powers of Europe signed a peace treaty that saw the return of most maritime conquests. The French agreed to evacuate southern Italy, Malta, and Egypt to be returned to the Ottoman Empire. However, the treaty made no provisions for the respecting of boundaries between existing European states. During a 14-month peace with the French, France briefly became a tourist destination for the British to see what Republican France looked like. But it was not to last. By May 1803, they were back at war after both nations violated their previous treaty. Napoleon immediately occupied Hanover and then began to make plans to invade Great Britain. He partially paid for the invasion through the Louisiana Purchase. He sold over 800,000 square miles of continental America to the United States for $15 million. While the French had the measure of the British on land, they had proven inferior against the Royal Navy. This would be a true test for the French. Fear of invasion encouraged George to reinstate William Pitt as Prime Minister in May 1804. A French army of 150,000 men mustered at Boulogne to prepare for invasion. Napoleon, so confident of success, struck medals to celebrate a victory against the British before a single ship had sailed. He could rely on a Spanish fleet. Britain recruited volunteers for the impending battle. The British tasked the navy with intercepting the French fleet to prevent it reaching Britain. Led by Horatio Nelson, known for his tactical supremacy and unorthodox tactics, commanded HMS Victory attacked the French fleet at Trafalgar on the 21st of October, 1805. They attacked the French at right angles, breaking through and shattering the lines of French Vice Admiral Pierre-Charles Villeneuve. By sailing straight into the enemy fleet, the British threw the French into a state of confusion, cutting them off. The British, precipitating a melee, worked harder and faster with guns designed for short-range battering. Meanwhile, Admiral Collingwood destroyed the rear. As the ships became entangled, The guns were used to kill at point-blank range. From his perch in the upper rigging of a French ship called the Redoutable, a French sharpshooter took aim on the deck of HMS Victory, sending a musket ball into the shoulder of Horatio Nelson. He was carried below deck as fighting raged on. At the very moment of victory, Nelson died, with the knowledge that the French had been defeated. Villeneuve was captured. The French lost 20 of their ships, along with 14,000 men. The British had lost 1,500 men, but not a single ship. They had gambled on the French-Spanish commanders being poorly organised and trained. It had paid off. At Trafalgar, Napoleon had lost his opportunity to invade Great Britain. Napoleon turned his attention instead to land, continental Europe. Despite Britain using its significant wealth to fund allies on land to fight the French, Napoleon's enemies melted away. He won a string of major battles in the Battle of Ulm and Austerlitz in 1805, Jena and Auerstadt in 1806, and Friedland in 1807, against an alliance of Russia, Austria, Sweden and Prussia. The result of a demolition left most of Europe from the English Channel to the Russian border, either part of the French Empire, controlled by France, or allied through a treaty. From 1807, Napoleon began installing his family and friends as sovereign leaders across Europe, including his brothers. Joseph became King of Naples, and Louis became King of Holland. Napoleon's conquest of Europe and formation of the Confederation of the Rhine forced the end of the Holy Roman Empire in Central Europe in August 1806, an entity considered the legitimate continuation of the ancient Roman Empire, an entity that had existed for over 1,000 years. Napoleon then invaded Portugal and Spain in 1807 and 1808, installing Brother Joseph as King of Spain. Napoleon continued his domination of Europe when he invaded the Papal States. In response to being excommunicated, Napoleon captured the Pope Pius VI and imprisoned him in France, where he later died. By 1812, Napoleon was readying the French for their greatest challenge, a march on Moscow. But while Napoleon mustered over 500,000 men to the Russian frontier, Britain, who had been distracted with war on the Iberian Peninsula, had taken their eyes off their 13 former colonies. In June, James Madison, President of the United States, declared war on their old masters. There had been tensions due to British support of Native Americans against US expansion in the Northwest Territories. These tensions were exacerbated when the Royal Navy enforced tight restrictions on American trade with France in the hope of cutting off supplies. The Brits were also forcing Americans from US ships, many British-born, to fight in the Royal Navy. In 1810, Congress passed Macon's Bill. If either Britain or France removed trade restrictions with the US, they would cut off trade with the other. Napoleon quickly took the Americans up on their offer, thus the US cut off trade with the British. In June 1812, the US invaded British-controlled Canada. While the Americans achieved some naval victories, Britain maintained a blockade on the eastern seaboard. Soon, US forces were driven back across the border by the British and Indian Confederacy. They were pursued, and Detroit was taken. The US then took back Detroit following a naval victory in Lake Erie. Meanwhile, Napoleon's troops arrived in Moscow to find it abandoned and burning. After much deliberation, Napoleon decided to retreat in Arctic conditions as winter closed in. On the long, deadly march back to Paris, Napoleon's men died of cold, were ravaged by disease, and terrorized by their enemies. By some estimates, the Russians lost at least 200,000 men. out of the 600,000 French troops who set off east to conquer Russia, only around 100,000 made it home. Napoleon arrived in Paris defeated. In April 1814, he abdicated the throne and was banished to the Mediterranean island of Elba. Louis XVI's brother became Louis XVIII as the monarchy of France was fully restored. With Napoleon defeated, the British could concentrate on the United States. In August 1814, British troops arrived at Chesapeake Bay. From there, they entered Washington, D.C. and burned the White House. The U.S. were, however, able to resist a British advance to New York and Baltimore. By the end of the year, peace talks had begun. With France subdued, neither side saw the benefit of a continuation of war. The Canadian borders remained unchanged, and Britain abandoned its support of the Native Americans. However, word had not reached a British force in New Orleans. It attacked. General Andrew Jackson subdued the British, cementing a lasting national pride. Back in Europe, in February 1815, Napoleon slipped away with a small fleet and landed on the coast of France. A swelling regiment joined Napoleon on a march to Paris. After 11 months in exile, Napoleon was back. Louis XVIII fled. The crowned heads of Europe were meeting in Vienna to attempt to tidy up post-Napoleonic Europe at the exact moment Napoleon returned. He was declared an outlaw. Russia, Prussia, Austria, and the UK vowed to end his rule once and for all. Europe was once again at war. On the 16th of June, Napoleon defeated the Prussians at Ligny and held the British, commanded by the Duke of Wellington, at Quatre Bras. But Napoleon failed to eliminate either force. 2 days later, on the 18th of June, the British met the French at Waterloo, in modern-day Belgium. Wellington's forces were hammered, but held their ground as the French failed to break through. In the afternoon, having retreated from Ligny, the Prussians arrived just as Napoleon had committed all of his troops to the field. The French were outnumbered and retreated in chaos. Napoleon had lost 33,000 men to 23,000 Brits and Prussians. Napoleon returned to Paris. It was his final defeat. Europe's intermittent war with the French was over after 18 years. Napoleon wrote to King George's son in an attempt to seek asylum. "I have terminated my political career, and I come, like Themistocles, to seat myself at the hearth of the British people. I put myself under the protection of their laws, which I claim from your Royal Highness as the most powerful, the most constant, and the most generous of my enemies." As Louis XVIII once again sat on the French throne, Napoleon was exiled once more, this time to the lonely Atlantic island of St. Helena, where he died in 1821. During the final 5 years of the Napoleonic Wars, King George was absent and alone. In 1810, he had celebrated 50 years on the throne. The country threw its first ever Golden Jubilee, while Henry III, Edward III, and James VI of Scotland had ruled for over 50 years, neither had celebrated the event with such pomp. The event of 1810 was described, "a people happy, great and free, that people with one common voice, from Thames to Ganges, common shores rejoice in universal jubilee." It would be George's last hurrah. The following year, his illness struck once more, this time into a permanent insanity. In February 1811, Prince George became the Prince Regent of the United Kingdom and assumed all of his father's duties. The old king was exposed to seclusion and restraint. he was cut off with no news from the outside world. George was blind and almost completely deaf. He had developed dementia. He had a long white beard and would wander around the secluded rooms of Windsor Castle in a purple dressing gown. He would ramble nonsensically, literally for days at a time. He would not have been aware of Napoleon's return from exile, nor the assassination of Prime Minister Spencer Percival. He wouldn't have been aware that due to Hanover's upgrade, he was now King of Hanover. He didn't even recognise his family. In 1818, Queen Charlotte died. George would not have understood the news. She had claimed that since her wedding day, she had never known a moment of sorrow. On the 29th of January, 1820, the king finally died of pneumonia at the age of 81. He was interred at St. George's Chapel, Windsor Castle. He was, and is, as of 2022, the longest lived and longest reigning king in British history. No king had ever seen such a colossal transformation of society, industry, and technology. He is often known as the man who lost America. Indeed, his obstinacy helped create such political difficulties, and it could be argued that he was the final monarch to seriously endeavour ruling Britain himself. Described as a wicked tyrant by Thomas Paine, his domestic image was rather different. He was subjected to satire and ridicule due to his simple tastes. His image was that of a simple man with a common touch, who ensured stability but acted as a visible contrast to the hot-headed, excessive rulers on the continent surrounded by flummery of ceremony. In an age which saw absolute monarchies replaced with republics, the British monarchy survived. George III's character, despite his many shortcomings, may well have contributed. Thank you for listening. Join us next time for The Prince Regent, George IV. As always, you can send in your messages to the Kings and Queens Podcast at gmail.com, Kings Queens Pod on Twitter, and Kings Queens Podcast on Instagram. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.